I also want people to show up for Black life. I also want people to think about the systemic barriers that make it challenging for Black people to live, but also for the first environment, which is the womb, right? What is the threat to your existence when you haven't even been born yet?
Hi, everyone. True Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. I'm excited to interview my dear friend Latham Thomas, who's one of the most well-known doulas that are out there. And she's an incredible person who helps and supports women to embrace their optimal wellness and spiritual growth as a pathway to empowerment. She does that through a lot of different ways, but one of the primary ways that she's known for is being a doula, a birthing coach, somebody that helps women and families create the best experience around their birth and really speaks up and gives the women voice. So before I tell you a little bit more about Latham, why I'm excited about this interview is that on this podcast, we're committed, and on Doctor's Pharmacy with my business partner, Dr. Mark Hyman, we're committed to highlighting voices to talk about issues of systemic injustice, especially racial injustice and inequalities inside of our healthcare system. And Latham has been speaking forever about some of the inequalities that Black, Native American, and Latino communities face when it comes to childbirth. Women, did you know that Black women are 3 times more likely to die in childbirth than the rest of the population? That's crazy. If you want to read some of that, we have the notes inside of the show notes for a few articles that'll help educate you on that. And we're going to be talking about that with Latham, who's not only a doula who works with very well-known individuals, many celebrities that you've heard of, but it's also trying to give a voice to the voiceless and saying we need to change our healthcare system here in the U.S. to make it better and more harmonious for everyone involved. So that's what we talk about in today's interview. So a little bit about Latham. Latham is one of she's one of Oprah's Super Soul 100. This is 100 people that Oprah has handpicked as some of the leaders of the next generation who are doing incredible work, and Latham is on there. She's leading a revolution in radical self-care, guiding women everywhere to mother themselves first. She's the founder of Mama Glow, a global women's health and education brand serving women along the childbearing continuum. Mama Glow supports women and families during the fertility period, pregnancy, birth, as well as during postpartum, offering handholding through their bespoke doula services. She's the author of a book. It's out in paperback now. It's called Own Your Glow, a soulful guide to luminous living and crowning the queen. This was released back in last year, I believe, or a couple years ago. It's been out, but it just came out in paperback on June 16th. So with all that being said, I'm excited to present you my friend Latham, and for this far wide-ranging conversation on all things health and wellness and how we can look after those who need attention and support the most. Here we go. Welcome, Latham, to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you so much, Drew, for having me.
Oh, it's an honor. We've been friends for a while, and we were trying to do this in person. I was like in January, pre-COVID and everything. Latham, when are you going to be in LA? Then the world turned upside down.
Here we are.
You know, I want to say, and I want to acknowledge you for, you know, during this time of all the awareness around racial violence, you've been such a voice around not only addressing that topic from the perspective of a mother, a doula, and also somebody that's firmly in the wellness community, teaching people how to like embrace self-care during this time period, but you're also have been using these really tragic and unfortunate events that have been happening to put the spotlight on other racial disparities that are in the space of health and wellness. So I want to thank you for that, because that's really part of the deeper education that comes along, and you've been doing such a great job of doing that for communities that are out there.
Oh, true. Thank you. I mean, I feel like that's what we are supposed to be doing with our energy and our influence when we can. And it is exhausting, I think, to right now be in the space sharing and, but because you feel like sometimes these things that you're saying, you're repeating, and you feel like you're a broken record sometimes. But I think the beauty of it is that I'm finding that so many people are learning these things for the first time, and that it's giving them an entry point to the information. So I feel really good about that.
And I think that, you know, these are things, as you've mentioned, you've been talking about for a while, and they just don't always get the attention that they deserve. So I want to start at the basics before we jump into your story. A big part of your work and the movement you're doing with Mama Glow is birth activism. Tell us what that is, and also help us understand the context of it as it comes to, you know, different racial disparities that are out there.
Sure. So I think, you know, what people tend to think about when they think pregnancy and birth, there's like a spectrum, but it's either, oh, it's this beautiful, incredible, life-changing experience, or what we see on TV is that it's painful, it's inconvenient. And where we fall is that we want people to have the experience that they desire, that they deserve. We want it to be one where people feel empowered and supported in their humanity, and that when they show up, whether it's in a hospital setting, a birth center, or if they're in the comfort of their home, that they are supported with the tools, care providers, clinical support, and expertise that can accommodate their situation. What's important right now for people to understand in the context of this current climate, but also just in general, is that we're in the midst of a bunch of crises, right? And, you know, COVID-19 hit us. And as that started to unfold, what became really clear was that our medical system is fraught. It is fragile, and it is overextended. And so when we have people who are already not being addressed, they end up falling through the cracks. And people ask, well, who are those people? What does that even mean, right? How does a system that's designed to help people actually miss helping them and instead end up causing harm? Well, for people to understand how we get there, it's important to understand sort of the disparities in birth outcomes. So the CDC released a report for this year, for 2019, going into 2020. So in 2019, they released a report with new stats that showed that Black women and Native American women are 4 to 5 times more likely than white women to die during childbirth or due to childbirth-related causes. And so what that means is that any comorbidities that exist are exacerbated. So some of those comorbidities can be asthma, diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, and sometimes blood disorders, right? These are things that can like exacerbate those health outcomes. And the things that we don't have metric for, but that we know makes a difference, is the lived experience of racism and the sort of systemic barriers that people have to healthcare, to adequate healthcare, to access. People living in food, not only food deserts, so obviously food is a major thing, and being food insecure is a huge threat to your health, but also living in like maternity deserts, right, where you don't have access to clinical providers, that they're really far away, and to get care, it's distances that you have to drive to get there. You know, not having adequate medical insurance and that kind of coverage. Not having consistency in providers, right? So providers constantly changing, not having access to medical data and your information to really know what's going on for you. And then being underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed also happens in a time like this. And so, you know, the experience of going into these settings also, you know, is different, right? So for a white woman or white person who goes into the hospital versus a Black person, that experience is different because there are microaggressions, there's medical racism, there's all these things that kind of fall into play that are now coming to the surface in terms of conversation and being factored in as issues that we have to address. You know, the other piece that I would say too that everybody can probably feel now is like, we all sort of have been affected by this existential stress, this sense of anxiety, overwhelm, right? That's been a result of this new experience that we've been in. We've been in the house for 3 months, and then that was followed by, you know, this huge upswell of the racial injustice and then protests, right? Which has, I think, sparked a lot of energy inside people, but not energy they necessarily know what to do with, right? And so there is a sense of anxiety, of tension, even of depression for many people right now. And chronic stress that somebody may carry can compound these issues that can become disease, right? And so these things are like all part of a woven, intricate net of issues that can create the disparities that we see. And there's a long historical framework that has shaped these disparities, which we can talk about later, but that's kind of the, you know, the sort of overarching, I guess, theme that I see is that, you know, I love that people are showing up right now, and I love that folks are standing up for the lives of, you know, Black folks who've been murdered, you know, Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd and you know, so many others that we don't even count because it's like you would spend all day naming them. But I also want people to show up for Black life. I also want people to think about the systemic barriers that make it challenging for Black people to live, but also for the first environment, which is the womb, right? What is the threat to your existence when you haven't even been born yet? What are the systems that are working on you before you arrive, right? Like, we need to be figuring out how to change that too, not just go in the streets when someone dies, but we also need to be, you know, talking to policymakers to change what is already in place that's harmful for people who are trying to live.
It's so key. And, you know, I think the thing is that there's all sorts of different people from my community and different backgrounds that are listening right now. And besides just the human element of wanting to make sure that everybody has that chance to really come into this world, you would hope with the same slate and other aspects. For anybody that's listening that feels like, let's say that they're paying attention, but they notice themselves that's more skeptical, like, okay, well, what does this have to do with me? Well, the thing is that, you know, when one group, any group experiences extreme, especially health injustice that's there, if you're a taxpayer, you're going to have to pick up the bill for it, right? Besides just the human element of it, it's like the health of one of our groups in society is the health of all of us as a whole. And we know that when people are healthier and they're happier and they score lower on the ACEs study, you know, adverse childhood experiences, and they have less trauma and other stuff, they're better people for society. They can contribute more. They become better employees. So it's like, we really have to think holistically here and really make it something that we care about. Otherwise, we will have this split. You can kind of already see it right now in wellness. You have some people that are just very healthy and have access to this information. You know, many of our friends, probably, you know, us in this circle that we're in, there's another group of people that just don't have access to it. So this isn't the bridge that we want to create. We want to bring it together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, it has to become your issue, right? Like, it can't just be like, oh, well, I'm not in my childbearing years anymore. Or, oh, well, I'm not Black. Or I'm not, it's like, or I'm not a woman, right? Or I'm not a, I don't have a uterus, right? Like, it can't be just the issue of who it seems to be affecting the most, right? Like, it has to become all of our issue. It has to become a human rights issue. I mean, I see the same thing when it comes to our LGBTQ plus family. It's like, we can't be like, oh no, I'm not that, so I'm not gonna stand up for them. What does that mean? No, we all have to stand up. Like, our bodies are also needed on the front lines, right? So I think it has to be that we start to see, like you said, see ourselves and everyone, see how we're connected, and find those ways to weave our stories together so that we can center all of us, right? And especially those on the margins, because if we don't If we don't design the future to meet the needs of those who are on the margins, we're not designing the future. We're just creating more of the past, right? And we will all eventually fall through the cracks because these other people are just first, right? Doesn't mean that it's not going to come get us, right? And so whoever us is. So I think that, it's like, you watch these things like The Handmaid's Tale and all this stuff that's out and shows dystopian society. And it's like, people think that like they're not, like there will never be an issue that'll touch them, that, oh, this is everyone else. There's always going to be something that impacts you or someone you love. And so it's so important to use your voice because there are always going to be people who show up and use theirs when an issue matters for you. And so you just want to be, I think, not just only on the right side of history, but also you want to show that you have empathy and solidarity to align with the struggle of your siblings, right? Like, and we all really have to see ourselves as family or else we're not going to get anything done.
I remember reading an article, I believe it was last year, it came out on NPR and they even did a little bit of a story on it where some of those, I think that report that you had mentioned earlier by the CDC just got released. And the point that they were making about these disparities in certain communities that are especially focused in Black, Latino, Native American, that the level of birth rate deaths of women was on par with, countries in Africa and other third world countries that people were in. It was like that level of maternal death that was happening there. So part of this is also an education for people of like, hey, we often tend to focus on what can we do for people in India, where I'm from, or what can we do from Kenya, where I was born, or, what can we do for over here or these other countries? But that stuff is happening over here too. And that's part of the attention that you're bringing to the surface. And I think that's going to be news for a lot of individuals. And we'll link to that article and that report in the show notes for anybody who's interested. I find that the context that's very helpful for us is looking back on our history and understanding how did we get here? So I would love for you to just share a little bit of that. Like, how did we even get into this situation on our very recent history that created this divide?
Sure. I mean, just in my little corner of the world, right? I would say it's important to understand, everything is history, right? So I love that you want that framing. Our medical system's really young, and so is our country, right? And so this idea of obstetrics, which was, when medicine and science weren't like married like they are now, 400 years ago, science was science was like a really powerful, respected space to be in, and medicine was still like trying to prove itself, right? And so you had all these thinkers that were trying to figure out like, how do we do this work in a way, and all globally connected, right? And so in this new world, quote unquote, when folks got here and started to develop what will become the nascent form of medicine, which was obstetrics, it was not respected. It was not a respected form of medicine. And so there was also not a lot of, evidence, right? Because to kind of get to that place, they had to also study the female body, which for hundreds and hundreds of years was sort of like outlawed because the church and state, the church and state were always like this, right? The church was like, no, like women are fallen. They are forbidden. They are, they're sinners, so there was this whole consciousness that like, you didn't have to study the female body, but you could study the male body. And there, in all of science, it was really driven towards like everything, like any pathologies that were experienced, through the male body were studied. There was also like a fierce pathway towards cure for disease. And we still see this today, right? Where, if it's anything that affects men, there's a pill for it. There's a cure for it. There's something, but it's fast tracked. It's a concern, right? And so the sort of default is the male body, right? The default is not female, right? And so here we are in the new world with these doctors seeking to understand the anatomy of the pelvis. And so it wasn't science that was racialized, it was medicine that was racialized. So medicine, right, in medicine, they sought to find differences in a black female's pelvis and a white female's pelvis. And so a lot of these medical journals that you'll find in the 1700s will describe black bodies in this way of like being savages and of being like almost superhuman, and how white female bodies were really dainty and black female bodies were almost like animals.
Animals that couldn't experience pain in the same way.
Pain.
It was sort of lowering them on the you know, they're not human. They're
humanity. Yeah, no humanity. But also that that they were hypersexual. And so this idea that they were diseased, but they were being raped, right? And so what was happening is you have like the first Africans coming to the United States forcibly through the slave trade in 1619, so 400 years ago, right? Arriving to these shores. Upon arriving here, traveling, by the way, in darkness for months in a boat, right? Weeks, and coming through the Middle Passage. Now, as they're traveling through the Middle Passage, by the way, many of whom are midwives, many of whom are delivering babies in the darkness of the belly of these ships. Many of the women who were taken, by the way, were raped before they left. And so they would arrive here already pregnant. These women, these African women, would not only birth the babies of enslaved women, but also the babies of the slave master, the mistress. They would also wet nurse. And so their milk was used to feed the babies of the the master. And if there was no doctor around, they would also take care of that family because they had all of this ancient wisdom, right, around plant medicine, around midwifery, right? And so they brought all that knowledge with them. You know, when they traveled, they also knew they were leaving. This idea that they were just kidnapped, and no, they knew. There was a consciousness. And so many people knew they were leaving and that they weren't coming home. And so on them, they would, you know, plant seeds. So in their hair, seed, so they could have their sorghums and herbs and things that they were used to when they got here. And they would shake out their hair and that seed, right, or whatever, it would come out in their excrement. It would come out from their bodies, off of their scarves and garments. And so this idea of like trying to bring with you like something from home so that you could take care of yourself when you arrived, right? And they brought with them so much wisdom. And so all of that was a foundation because they were doing all of the medicinal work that was happening for women. They were doing that, right? And then the sort of obstetrical model was just starting to come into place. And so they brought these granny midwives in and said, hey, we want to learn the techniques. We want to also teach you sanitation, all these things. Like, we want to sort of find a way to like, you know, standardize what you're doing. And so they did. They brought them in and they observed what they did. They learned a lot from them. There were also slave hospitals that were also operating where there were these women who not only were nurses, doctor's assistants, they were also, many of them, raped and used as subject matter for to like basically fix pathologies in white women. Their bodies were used for that. And they did not have a choice of whether or not they could be a part of an experiment. Many of them were, I think people know about J. Marion Sims, who was called the father of modern gynecology, who raped and many of these women, and he had a statue in Central Park, which just was taken down like 2 years ago, but raped many women and used their bodies and operated on them and without anesthesia and did all types of things. And all of the tools that we use now in gynecology were tools that he developed and at the expense of black women, right? And so that's like the framework, right? It's tons of violence, tons of harm, pain. And so there is a mistrust of the medical system already because of that. Like, you don't have to have experienced that It's in our blood, right? It's already a fear. And so that gets passed down. And those values and those ways of thinking about Black women and their bodies have carried through medicine. There's never been like a, like some sort of reckoning, like, hey, by the way, we caused some harm, we need to address this, or we've thought this way. No, instead, med students still to this day that I talk to in 2020, like still think like, oh yeah, no, Black women are really strong. Like they can tell, they can totally, you know, they have a higher pain tolerance. It's a belief today, okay, by well-meaning med students, right? So
and I just want to add into that, Freakonomics did a whole series called Bad Medicine. It was a three-part series by Freakonomics. And inside of there, they talked about some of those things. For anybody who actually wants more information and how these some of these components are still in the medical literature, that's a fantastic series to get into around all the myths that have just become baked and never readdressed.
Never readdressed, exactly. And so that is how we get to a place then where we see these disparities come up around the lived experience of racism inside of the medical system, right? Of where racism shows up as neglect, or it shows up as microaggressions, or it shows up as inconsistent care. It shows up as, you know, lack of validation or not validating what someone's experiencing, not supporting their clinical needs, right? So all of this shows up, and it leads to outcomes like we've seen where someone's inside of the care of the hospital with their provider and may not make it out alive, right? Like that cannot, like you can't even fathom that. Many people can't fathom it, but it happens all the time. And I talk to so many families that have lost loved ones who were healthy when they went in and did not make it out, or shortly after, right? And if they survived, you know, like then it's a situation of like morbidity. They survived, and it's a really challenging life that they have now. Like they were really, there was a lot of harm done, and their life is severely impacted by that near miss. Mm.
When you really look at it and you get a chance to study it, that's where you understand, you know, so many people who have an opinion on things and want to talk, but have not looked at the history. It's like, well, let's take a step back and let's understand the implications of it all. Yeah. So I want to come into a little bit of your story and pause for a second and come back to some of those the conversations around birth activism. You know, let's talk about your passion of even being somebody who's been in this space, wanting to be somebody who gives access to the doula experience to so many more individuals, raising the voice around it and talking about what it means to have an advocate for you through all the phases that are there that a woman and families would go through. So take us to the beginning. Like, where did this passion come from? I've heard you tell the story of Fulanu's birth.
Yeah.
tell us a little bit about how did you get involved in this space?
Yeah, well, I always, you know, thank you for that question. You know, I always say that it's really a calling and not a passion, because I feel like a passion is something that, like it's something that you can do leisurely and enjoy. And a calling is something that like, it's like you don't get a choice. You have to be obedient to it. It is inconvenient. It is like, you're like, why me? You know what I mean? And you have to answer it. Like you don't have a choice, because it keeps showing up until you answer. And then once you do, it's like floodgates open, Jesus swans dives out of heaven and is like, here's your path, right? And for me, that's what it was. It was like, I was resistant to it. I didn't have my son and know that I was gonna be a doula. I did have my son and know that I was going to affect the work in a powerful way after that experience, because it was so life-changing and beautiful. But I didn't know that it would be doula work, right? And it took a journey. And in fact, it was a Vedic astrologer who told me on my birthday that I was supposed to mother the mother. Okay, he did a reading, and there was like a puja for my birthday, and then a reading, and then he said that, and I was like, well, I'm doing that. He's like, no. He's like, you have to mother the mother. It's deeper than you're already doing it. Mm-hmm. And when he said that, I was like, it was so powerful. And it led me to like some numerology. He gave me some numbers, and those numbers correlated with a doula fellowship program. The day that I got the email that I was accepted to the program was one of the numbers that he gave me. And so I was like, okay, cool. Like, I get it. I'm supposed to do this, right? And so I just accepted the call. Now, I was somebody who's very protective of my time, so I was in my sleep, and I was like, I don't know. Like, but guess what? My life was for years getting up in the middle of the night, putting my son in his little snowsuit, hailing a cab, because there was no such thing as Uber, hailing a cab, getting in the cab at 3 a.m. with my son, taking him to his grandfather's house with his snacks and everything he would need, and then heading from there, hailing another cab, and then going to Brooklyn in the middle of the night to someone's birth, right? Like, it's totally inconvenient, but it is like riveting, and it is a calling, and it is an honor of my life, right? And so for me—
And can I jump in real quick? I think that some people are listening and they've heard the word doula, even though our audience is probably, you know, mostly women, but other people are listening and they're like, I know what it is, and I kind of don't know what it is. So could you explain what a doula is?
Yeah, sure. So a doula is a non-clinical care provider who essentially shows up to provide emotional support, physical support, psychological, educational support, partner support, right? If there's a partner present, and then advocacy tools, right? So helping you to navigate this experience of how you'll engage with the system as you move through this process, right? Into new parenthood. They support you at any point. So you can hire one, you know, like as early as your, you know, second trimester. Some people hire people days before they're going to deliver, right? It just depends on, you know, where you're at, but there's always somebody to show up for you. In every financial bracket, you can get a doula. It doesn't have to be, it's not just for rich people or whatever type of people, it's for all people. So there's always one available, including folks who do community-based doula work where they do pro bono, right? And it's like basically like having a producer for your birth. That's what my clients say, right? Like it's like having someone who's there that's anticipating your needs, right? Like your emotional needs, like what's gonna help you to feel transcendent. Because what a lot of people don't realize is birth is really a meditation. And so to ascend out of like your thinking brain and get out of like beta, you have to like be in a meditative state, which means you have to feel safety. And once you feel that safety, you can ascend. Right? And your brain and your body can work together to produce the cocktail of hormones necessary to facilitate labor. And that's only possible when we can get into the primal aspect of ourselves. And so what the doula provides is almost like this, like for the modern women. What'd you say?
It's like also like a buffer for the women who are going
like
through
a buffer.
It.
Absolutely. A buffer. But yeah, like, so you're holding this space, but also you're filling the void that has been designed by this new way of modern living, right? Like we don't live in villages anymore. So it's like a person who's the protector of that birth village or that birth keeper, right? Who kind of can help gel a situation together, can help be the energy glue, right? For the vibe, right? And so if we're living in our communities like we used to be, then you would have already that person who would come in. You would have these folks show up. But now we live far apart from our families and we live in an accelerated pace. And so modern living makes it really challenging for pregnant people and new parents, right? And so the doula, the role is so much more than just birth support. It really is like helping create that energetic seal around that experience for people.
That's powerful. And you got that invitation, that calling, right? Yeah. That hero's journey. You got that invitation to your hero's journey.
Yep.
And you went through that schooling and program and, you know, you embodied this and became a doula and were practicing it. Tell us about some of the early experiences that you had in being there for women. You know, let's take it a little bit more personal.
Well, I mean, I remember one of the first ones that was really amazing was, this couple who was in Jersey, and it was beautiful because she was Buddhist and he was Muslim. And one of the things that I teach doulas to ask, you know, when you're meeting with clients and just getting to know them and creating this safety, is, you know, is there anything in your spiritual practice that I should know about, right? And in that question, you know, it invites people to share what's intimately important to them and what would make them feel safe in an experience and expression of birth that will ritualize it, right? And so what we were able to do is he said, you know, it'd be really important for me to pray. And I would like a room where it was facing east so that I could pray. I could bring, you know, my prayer carpeting and I could, you know, put up things in the room that would make me feel like I could be in the masjid, even though, you know, I'll be in the delivery room. And I was like, cool. And so we just like arranged that. Mm. And then the mother had the things that were important for her. And she brought like little images and she had like these, her mother brought an orange tree. I mean, it was amazing, but it was like a setup, right? And they both felt at home, right? And it was the middle of a hospital in New York City, actually. She didn't deliver in Jersey, she delivered in the city. And it was a beautiful setup and a beautiful experience, I think, to know that like, if he was also an immigrant. And so for him, he didn't have facility over the English language or, you know, so for him, it was like the things that made him feel comfortable were rooted in his rituals around prayer. And because his baby was on the way, he was just like, I just want to pray, right? And that made him feel at home. And so I feel like those early experiences of sort of getting it right, right? Like knowing that someone has to feel themselves, they have to feel safe to be able to show up for their partner and making sure that he felt safe, that he could show up in a way that was going to help his wife. That was amazing, you know? And so that was one of the earlier ones that I loved. And I mean, I've been at so many. My most recent home birth, I think that was really beautiful, was amazing too. I mean, there's so many like that. I can't find one little thing, but what I will say is I've had some too, where I had one of those things where two people on the same day, it was like parent trap or whatever that's called, where, you know, it was like two people on the same day where one was Jersey, one was a city. And I was like, oh my God. But it turns out that one did deliver and the other one was like, it was like a false preterm situation. Like I had another doula go to her. It turned out like it, you know, we were able to like keep her pregnant for a couple more weeks. But I was like, this is not happening right now. It's not possible that they like, that has never really happened. I've had people come days apart, but never the same day. So it was like one of those things where you're like, you really hope that they don't stack on top of each other. That happened once. And that happened very early on too.
Can you give us an example of where you or a doula would really have to advocate for somebody, especially let's say, you know, often somebody who may not know how the system, the medical system as a whole, let's say not everybody has a home birth. You know, you could choose to have a hospital birth. You could have everything and you can still have a doula, whatever your preference is. Is there an example of a time where you or where a doula would typically have to advocate really on behalf of the mom and the baby for their own health and well-being?
It's a great question. And so, and I want to clarify two things. Well, one thing really, which is that, you know, our role is to really educate and provide you with the platform and the sort of courage to be able to advocate for yourself so that you're speaking the words to your provider, you're the one communicating, because how consent works is really like, I cannot provide consent for you, right? So I can speak alongside you, I can support, I can be a liaison, but I can't like advocate for you so much as I can like support your advocating, right? So that's one thing I want to make sure people get, is that it is all speaking together, but I'm never going to go talk to your doctor over here while you're over here and say something like, we're all together and you and I have spoken, like me and Drew had our little powwow. Now, you know, the doctor comes back and now it's like, okay, Drew, like you want to share what we've sort of decided, you know, and then you're able to communicate. And I'm here to sort of kind of decode the information to help you better understand what was shared. And buy us time, but not to like speak on your behalf. And so I think that's something that I think a lot of people think they should be doing, like, oh, let me, you know, do this for you. But then it's like, no, we want to empower the parents, because there's moments where I'm not going to be there, right? And if I'm not there and I haven't taught you, right, and helped you practice how to navigate this, then I haven't done my part, right? So we should be doing that with people, like training them in different situations of how to answer certain types of questions or even ask certain questions. And even know that it's your right to ask, right? Because some people don't even feel safety in asking. And this is not a jab at doctors, right? Like, none of this is. It's really just an observation of a system that isn't working to support everyone, right? And so I have worked with incredible doctors. I respect most of them, right? Like, even, you know, even with differences in opinion, I respect people who show up in service of humanity and who show up in service of the work they were meant to do, right? And as long as we're getting to a healthy outcome for the birthing person and the baby, like, that's all we can hope for. But we have to work together, right? And so what that does mean, though, is understanding that there are unique needs for individuals who are going through this process that are not being met by our current medical model, and that there is something to learn about how the brain actually works, right? And how it works in situations when we're in the wild and in captivity, right? And so if I'm in a space where I feel safe and it's like my home environment, which many people do a lot of their early birthing at home, and then they're laboring, and then they head to the hospital to have the baby. When they're in that home environment, which is usually one where they feel safe, like, things are happening, you know, things move in a fluid fashion, usually because of that sense of safety at home. When you transfer to the environment of the hospital, where the lights are bright, where, you know, there's people coming in and out, the smells, the, you know, all of this, the sterile environment, it's like being in captivity. And it changes the hormonal response, because it changes what your brain perceives as safety, right? And so as a doula, I'm trying to make sure that we create safety, right? And that situation is paramount, like, to make sure we create that sense of safety first. And when that's under threat, then it's a discussion of, like, what tools I can use, what can be invoked, like the patient safety advocate. You know, there is an advocate that we can speak to if we feel like, you know, the client's needs are under threat. If we don't like the nurse or whoever, somebody's had an attitude, somebody was rude, whatever it is, right? There are points of entry to have this conversation. But there's also this idea that, like, in that moment where our client feels challenged, or we're in a situation where we're trying to move towards like we've been presented with information and now we have to make a choice. Sometimes in that moment, we're not able to process. We just have to show up to, like, that occasion. So whether it's like, oh, you thought you were having a vaginal delivery, now it's becoming a C-section. Now it's about, how do we now gather around this new information? Do we have time to bring in the doctor, maybe one of the people who's going to be in the OR, to sit at the bedside and explain, right? And talk us through this experience. You know, like, just bringing more humanity into it, right? And I think the other piece would be, you know, as a doula, your job is to make sure that informed consent is really what your client understands and can advocate for. And what that means is, you know, consent is this legal doctrine where, you know, a medical provider is to provide you with the information concerning a procedure prior to actually carrying out that procedure, right? And so not like after, or not like during, but like before, right? So what that looks like is, you know, before, instead of me just releasing my arm for you to take blood, which is cooperation, right? It's asking me if it's okay to draw my blood and for what reason, right? And then me then consenting and releasing my arm. And so consent really depends on four pieces of information, which is, first of all, is there a medical indication for this, right? Like, are we doing this because it's medically necessary, right? Like, we should know that before anything. Number one question, that's number one. Number two would be, what are the risks? Number three would be, what are the benefits? Number four would be, you know, what are the alternatives, even if those alternatives, even if there's no alternative, right? If we do nothing, what happens, right? So is there a medical indication? What are the, what is the nature of the procedure? What are the risks? What are the benefits? What if we do nothing, right? And if you get that information, you can make a choice, right? If I know all of those pieces of information, then I can make a choice. If I know none of that, I'm not choosing. I am cooperating. I might be coerced, but I'm not necessarily choosing. I'm not consenting. And so we want people to know that too. And so I would say the biggest thing that we can be doing is helping people understand what consent looks like and being able to advocate for that with or without us present as doulas.
That's so key because, you know, just this past weekend, we were hosting a going away party for a friend. And another mutual friend was there, and she is due in about like 2 to 4 weeks, somewhere in that time period. And she's working with a doula, right? Yeah. She's working with a doula.
Yes.
And that's their second baby. And she was, we were just talking about it. You know, I was there, I was asking great questions. They were giving great answers. And one of the things she was saying is that when I was working with my doula, I went in, and my first go around, I had these, I won't go into all the situation, but there was this complication at birth that ended up happening with the first baby. And the second go around, the doula and was providing some education that, hey, listen, sometimes these extra ultrasounds that are being done are not always medically necessary. Here's the reason to do it. Here's that. You should talk to your doctor and find out when you go in. And then the next time that she went in, she was like, look, is this ultrasound here, with everything being okay so far, is this necessary because I had X, Y, and Z complications last time? Is this going to take me closer to that? Is that going to take me further away from that? And they just had an honest conversation, and they were saying, well, okay, it's not necessary. You know, we don't have to do this for you right now. And it was just really brought light to, and they had their own opinions on the situation, that sometimes our medical system, especially here in the US, is there's an encourage, you know, most people have best interests, but sometimes the system leans towards extra and additional things because of insurance and billing and whatever else will be there. And, you know, we had Kieran Christensen on the podcast, and he's a microbiologist. And he was saying that, you know, also too, again, everybody, there's so many facets in it, and you can speak to it more elegantly than I can. He said, but if we're having additional, you know, ultrasounds that might be there that aren't always necessary, what's the implication for the vaginal microbiome, right? Yeah. So that was a conversation that was brought up. So these are just questions, and I think that the decision has to be coming from the woman, and but it's to have the information and to know that we can ask questions, that women can ask these questions and get the right answer and come to a decision, and not that the doctor or the healthcare provider will feel annoyed by it or like, I'm the expert and like, what are you doing, you know, asking this?
Yeah, it has to be a playing field where people feel safe, 100%. And I love that she was able to have this dialogue, right? And ask those questions and say, is this medically necessary? Because I would rather not, right? And to be able to have the information to know and say, okay, yes, let's do it or let's not, that's key, right? People need that, I think, and they deserve it, because by the way, like, the provider works for you, and people forget that. Like, you feel like you're imposing upon them, but they're working for you. So they're supposed to answer the questions. And I think because of the culture of medicine and how doctors are taught to sort of move through the world and how we're taught to perceive them, there is this sort of patriarchal, you know, higher versus lower, you know, kind of, you know, approach, right? That I'm supposed to look up to you. You stand over me when I come into the room. Like, there's a way that people just feel intimidated, and they shouldn't. And there's, I think, a lot of providers who work against that, who try to make sure that their clients feel safety, that they feel more like it's a friend. And there's a lot of younger doctors, I think, too, who are examining, you know, what it looks like to be in relationship with their clients, right? And trying to protect the patient and doctor relationship and make it one where they can get access to information that that would be critically important for health outcomes because they're trying to bridge that safety. So I think it's important to applaud people who are doing that and sort of, you know, show that that's what we need more of, because the more people feel safe, the more people feel like they're being heard, the more people feel that this is an option that is available to them and one that they can rely on, then the better we'll design, right? But I think right now we have to encourage people to explore all options. And I think that it's important for people to know that out of hospital birth is an option. I know that we have built systems against midwifery. We built systems against doulas, but it's an option that's really great for people who are low risk, right? We just have, I mean, just in COVID alone, right? We've seen that, you know, we don't have enough people to serve. And so you have all these people who want to do home birth or birth centers who came out of COVID, like, or into COVID, I should say, and was like, I don't want to do it in the hospital. Let me find a provider. And then guess what? There's no midwives available, right? Or they're stacked with clients, right? Because there's not enough. And so we have to think about that too. What does a future birth look like? How do we create more space, make it more affordable, so it's not as cost prohibitive for people to get the training they need to support, so that we can improve the outcomes? Because it shouldn't be something where if you want to do out of hospital birth that you have to jump through hoops to find somebody, that there's so much legislation against midwifery. In some states, it's actually illegal. Right, so we have to do a lot of work in this space to create protections around all the options. But it does start with us as individuals, right? Being able to speak up for ourselves, no matter what setting you're in, no matter what you've chosen or what you've been dealt with, like, you have rights and they're undeniable. And so it's important for you to feel like you can speak to those rights and be able to protect them.
So a lot of the work really is education and access, right? Through education and raising awareness, more people are aware. And that's part of this podcast here. And there's also access. And there's a lot of things that we can do on both fronts. So I'd love to hear from you, for our audience who's here, who's listening and saying, like, how can I support that process of education and access, especially for the communities that need it the most, the ones that are disenfranchised, the ones that typically would have higher incidences of, you know, deaths of the mother in the birthing process? How do we participate in the education, and how do we participate in the access?
Yeah, I love that question. I mean, I think, you know, if you feel called to do doula work, if you feel called to do midwifery work, please start researching organizations that you can align with, that you can get trained by. I think that for anybody, you know, we have these doula trainings that are now virtual, right? And it's been so amazing to have people from around the world. We used to always have people from around the world, but now it's like really like, you know, I mean, each class you're like, where is this? I haven't even, you know, heard of this country, right? Like, it's like amazing the types of folks that show up and from where and why they're coming. And many people come because they had an adverse experience in childbirth. Many people who've seen what's going on in the world, they want to make a difference. We have masters in public health. We have nurses. We have doctors even that are coming because they want to improve the experience in their practice, right? Nurses who want to be able to bring this work into the hospitals. So wherever you are, if you are someone who touches people along the journey, along this reproductive continuum, this is work that'll benefit you just to study, right? So doing a doula training, I think, could be really helpful. You know, if you feel called to do midwifery, amazing, we need more midwives. If you feel called to go to medical school, we need more doctors who are like really here to like shake things up, right? Also, if you want to support someone who is from a community, like a Latinx community, you know, a Native American community, you know, someone from the Black community that is doing this work or wants to do this work, you can also sponsor them for a doula training, or you can sponsor, you know, be one of the contributors to them being able to get their education sorted for midwifery training. You know, there's a lot of programs. We have one where it's scholarship based. I mean, our program, people can contribute to scholarships for people who are in need for financial aid.
And that's to get trained as a doula. That's for the training component.
Yeah.
And on the component that you were mentioning where, you know, if you also, so you have, we have that option, you can help to sponsor somebody and help them get a scholarship for the training. And for the option for a mother who's looking for a doula, are there organizations or places that you would direct our audience to?
Yeah, so pretty much all, I wouldn't say all of them, but I would say a lot of doula organizations. If you just reach out and say, hey, usually for donations, it can be split. So it's like, this is either for education or it's also for a support of families. So if you reach out and say, look, I want to sponsor a family, you can do that as well. So most organizations can support that. If it's not on the website, it's something that you could probably reach out just by an email to offer that type of support. And then I would say, in addition, you know, policy change is important, right? And so what we can be doing is making sure that our elected officials understand the importance of improving maternal health outcomes and why this is critically important to address right now. There's a bunch of bills, and I can send you information on some of the actions that are like critical for this year that people can be focused upon. But I would say, you know, wherever you are, don't think about just like the general election and presidential, but really be thinking about locally, like, you know, what's going on in the hospital near you, right? And what we can do to improve the outcomes there. Is there funding that's needed? Like, you know, that's why the census is also important to fill out, because depending on where you are and who you are and where you live, like where are resources gonna be allocated, right? That's gonna be important to do. I think also, you know, reading and staying up on the information, attending webinars, watching, you know, films can be really important in a way of advancing the conversation. There's really great journalism around this topic as well. And so I would say if you have a platform of any kind that you can be interviewing people who are doing this work, that you can be, you know, like, I mean, I'm in this conversation with Drew, which is obviously going to educate people who are then going to maybe say, oh, I want to do this, or I didn't know that, or who are going to share this information with someone else. And it's like, once we have it, we can then bring that to someone else, right? And their attention. And what I hope is that, you know, this will become something that's eradicated, that we're not still talking about this in 10, 20 years. Because what we have seen is that, you know, the Black maternal health crisis in this country has been on a 25-year increase, right? We've seen maternal deaths in general in the States have increased, and we're the only developed nation where maternal deaths are increasing. The only developed nation where that is like a constant, okay? Now, Black women, it's been for 25 years we've seen this uptick, right? So it's always been bad, but in the recent years, it's gone up for 25, right? What have we been doing in 25 years if not trying to address this, right? And so we have to, I think, also think about like where we sit in organizations that look at different points of entry when it comes to health. And the environment is one of them, right? So if we're thinking about like protecting the environment, what does that mean? What are the implications on the environment and the impact on climate change when it comes to Black and brown people who are usually living in areas where there's poor air quality, where there's poor access to food, where there's populations have asthma, usually also diabetes, hypertension, heart disease is common in these areas. But because of where they're located, also with the downwind, the air quality is really poor, right? And so when we think about, you know, where we're at in organization support, right? So how are these organizations also supporting Black people, right? And because this goes back to my whole conversation about life, right? Preserving life. So where do you sit at the sort of intersection, you know, in your work, in these conversations, right? Already, you don't have to like take on something new necessarily. You can look at like what you're already passionate about and see where it intersects with this conversation. And you're going to find there's an intersection, right? Mm. All of us will find that. And so, I mean, even this conversation right now with this podcast, of course, there's an intersection, right? And so I think that's our work, right? To find like, where are the concentric circles? Where do we come together? Where the overlap is that I can make the best use of my own skills and gifts. And if, when you find that, then you can take on this issue, you can see it as your own, and you can like shout from the rooftops like we need to, and not just make it about a moment of death, because I am really grateful that we see everybody pouring into the streets. This is important. It's critical, and we need it. We also need it to reverse some of the racist systemic policies that keep Black and Brown people from living full, actualized, self, you know, expressed lives, right? Like that has to be something that's also part of our agenda, and that, and there's so many buckets that lead us there. And so which ones are you engaged in where you can also be making sure that you're aligned in the struggle with these people to protect life from the very, very beginning?
Thank you for that. That was really fantastic. The other day I interviewed Reverend Michael Beckwith, and it'll be out on the podcast soon. Probably by the time that people see this one, that one will already have been out. And one of the themes this month for Agape is history in the making, participant or bystander.
Oof.
And yeah. I think that when we see that this is history in the making, and yes, there was death that sparked tremendous outrage because it was captured on film and it was horrendous. And that's important. And there's so many things that are important that are a part of that. We want this to be a holistic conversation, and that's how we keep it going. You know, there's so many conversations around, let's not just forget about this. How do we keep this going? Well, how we keep it going is we look at our own unique corner of the world and think about what we can bring to that.
Yes.
What can we bring to this situation? I'm involved in wellness. I'm involved in healthcare. I'm involved in these areas. What kind of conversations do we need to have or continue to have or double down on having so that everybody can think about how they can be a participant in history and making rather than a bystander?
That's right. That's exactly right. So succinct. You said it in like 5 words that I had to say in like 3 hours.
Latham, this has been fantastic. I want to get a chance, actually, as we're concluding up. You have a son, Fulano. We mentioned him a little bit earlier, and he's a beautiful, beautiful young gentleman. I remember, actually, funny story is in my last company, we hired him as a DJ. You know, he does DJing, is MCing, other things like that. And I think it was his first paying gig. I think you told me like a year later. It was his first paying gig, and he rocked the house. We threw a big party for this company that I was previously the CEO and an owner in, called the Clean Program. We were doing a big sort of celebration in New York as a way to give back to our community and connect people. And we had like an elixir bar with coconut water and all sorts of stuff. It was awesome. Fun. For your son in this time period, you know, before we started the interview, we were chit-chatting a little bit. I was just asking you how the family's doing as a whole. And I know that you've been sharing and educating and advocating and helping him understand, you know, from the time that he's born, if somebody is a boy or girl in the Black community, their parents are going to be having these conversations with them from the time that they're born, pretty much right away. In the context of what's happening here today, both with COVID-19 pandemic and also the racial pandemic, what do you see him paying attention to? What do you see him thinking about and wanting to be a focus of the conversations, or what conversations do you see him hosting? How do you see him navigating as a young man in the world in the midst of all this with all the education information that you provided him over the years?
It's such a great question. You know, what I can say about this quarantine period is that it's been deeply nurturing and nourishing for me and my son as a family, in that we have been home, we have been cooking together, we have been going on little runs. Well, I shouldn't say I've been going on runs with him, because he's 6'4", so it's not really a run with him. It's like watching him run from where I'm running. But we do like walks together, and we spend time. He does the DJing, but he also does music production. So he's working on an album. So I'm always hearing music, and which has been so lovely. And the cooking is great, because then we just talk a lot about stuff, or we'll sit on the stoop and just talk about life. And you know, he said that it was really challenging to see. I never watched the George Floyd video. I can't like watch death on, I can't even watch scary movies or watch death on like TV that's like fictional. So I don't want to watch it in real life. And I internalize it without seeing it just based on what's happening around us and what I've learned about the situation. My son saw it on Instagram and he didn't intentionally see it. He saw it and then he told me and he said, I'm sick to my stomach. And so we had to talk obviously about that. And he said, you know, what really was so real for him is that he's like, you know, it could be anybody. It could be me. It could be someone I love, you know? And it was upsetting for him, but it was also something that made him want to create. And so he made some videos of the protest and images along with his music. And he sort of, he created like these two really cool kind of montages on his social media. And he's just been pouring himself into the music. And right now he's in Berklee School of Music summer program. And he's also doing like a summer school thing with his school, whatever it is. I was like, you gotta go to school because you cannot just be hanging out since there's like no full open world yet. You gotta be at school. So he's doing another program at school as well. And the high school has a really powerful social justice track. And so he's doing some work around Latin America and the privatization of water. And sort of, you know, uncovering what that did to this region that they're actually studying. And so what I think for him is that it's opened up a world of question, for sure, of concern. But what it also has done, and what I've tried to do, is really focus on his joy and his liberation. And not having him walk through the world afraid. I do not want him to walk through the world and think that he's a target. I do not want him walking through the world, even knowing that this is how we're perceived. I don't want him walking through the world with that consciousness. Mm. And so I affirm him that like that he's protected and that he's safe and that, you know, our community village has raised him well, right? Like I'm not the only person who's made an impact. You've made an impact. Many people have made an impact. And so I know that I have to trust that he's safe and that he's making good decisions. And I also have to trust that, you know, that he's protected and for my own peace of mind, right? And so we have little things that we do to kind of make sure that I feel good. Like I need to know when you arrive. So they'll text me, hey, I just arrived, or, you know, that kind of thing where, you know, I feel more safe, you know, to know that he's safe. But when he's, you know, right now he's at his dad's house, but when he's here, Drew, I sleep so well because I know where he is 24/7. And for that to have been the peace that I didn't know I needed in quarantine, that was a real blessing. But what I hope for people who are listening, who may have children, if you're raising Black and brown children in this time, I just pray for you because I know it's not easy. I know that it's a challenge, but what I would recommend is that all of us reaffirm in our children their capacity for freedom, because I think if we get fully caught up in what we're seeing on the news, if we get fully caught up in just the statistics, if we get fully caught up in not like the individual that is in front of us, this child who does need to experience the world. Like we need to make sure that they know that that's their birthright, is to have joy and to have life experiences and not to be tethered by our fears. So that's a dance that I'm in. That's my commitment, is to like have him live in liberation, but also I have to like juxtapose that against my own fears for his safety, right? And that's not his to bear, that's mine. So I'm trying to move through that with him. But I would say, he's so compassionate. He's moved by what's going on. He's been involved in the protests. He does his bike protests. We go to the silent protests. We go to the marches. But I think for him, he's getting the expression that he needs right now to show his sense of solidarity as a person who has agency but who can't vote yet, you know, who wants to express himself politically. I think it's been great for him to be a part of this moment, even how painful this moment has been. It's been a good, I think it's been a good thing for him to experience, because all of us will have been touched by this year in some way, shape, or form. It's been challenging, but I hope that he comes on the other side and has some sense of how he wants to move through the world as an adult, based on the things that he was able to observe and participate in this year as a 16 going on 17-year-old. So I'm thankful that he's well and that he feels mentally strong, but I do worry that, like, you know, he hears too much or sees too much of this idea of being a target, you know, and that's heartbreaking.
I think that's a really important perspective for a lot of people to hear, because at the intersection that you're in, where you have your experiences and then your training as a doula, and then you're very firmly in the wellness world, we know that, you know, social media and TV, as great as they are to keep us informed in things, if we let that become our internal reality, then we not only have that, you know, it's like we've practiced and we've perfected the aspect of worry. Worry becomes part of who we are. Those images become part of who we are. And yes, we want to be aware, but there has to be a little bit of a buffer that we have, because, you know, I think about, like, Albert Einstein. You know, he said the most important question that a human being can ask himself is that, is the universe a force for good? Right? Mm-hmm. Do you believe the universe is a force for good? Is it something that's there for you? Is it there to lift you up? Is it there to provide you with joy, with experiences? And you can still feel that and believe that without feeling, with also being aware of the, with also being aware of the inequality. So we don't want to be, let the media primarily, again, well-intentioned, take us in one direction or another, that either it doesn't exist or that it's the only thing that exists. There can be a place of equanimity in the middle where there's awareness, but there's also an internal joy and creation inside that we know that we're, that it's, as you shared, it's our God-given right to experience.
Yes. Yes, true. All of that.
That's beautiful. Well, Latham, thank you so much for being here on the podcast to talk about this very important subject, and for sharing a little bit of a lot of knowledge on something that I don't think a lot of people are still fully aware of, myself included. I don't know all the stats that are there, especially that women of color experience when it comes to child labor, but I want to learn more and I want to highlight it more to our audience. You've been doing some incredible things. I want to give a chance to give a shout out for it. In addition to the training program, so people can find that at the Mama Glow website.
Yes, exactly. MamaGlow.com.
Fantastic. We'll have a link for that below. You've also written an op-ed recently that we'll have a link to. Can you mention that for our audience? Sure.
Yeah, I did an op-ed in Cosmo about COVID-19 and there was the Black maternal health crisis. And it was actually, like, one of their most popular op-eds for, like, 3 weeks. And they never write about pregnancy. So they were like, oh, interesting that people were, you know, moved, you know, by that piece and that topic. And I actually highlight the birth experience of a woman called Amber Isaac, who actually passed away during her birth, was not able to meet her son as a result of some of the some of the gaps, right, that occurred during this COVID crisis. And so just important to kind of learn about, like, you know, what's going on in this time and how do we better brace ourselves if something like this shows up again, right? How do we fill those gaps? And so the article does cover that, but it also talks about some of the other systemic inequities, and it's an easy read. So you can check it out on Cosmo.com.
Amazing. And you've done also some really great Instagram lives recently. I'm going to link to a few below so that people can check them out. Latham, any final words for our audience?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so thankful to be here. Drew is somebody who I love and who I admire and I've known for years. And this is like who he is always, you know, he just shows up in this way so powerfully. And so I thank you for that. And I would say, like, if you're interested, you know, in finding something to kind of ground yourself in this moment, you know, spiritually, thinking about like, how do I, you know, sort of come out of this moment like a little transformed, you know, my new book, well, actually my old book, but in new form in paperback, just released, called Own Your Glow. And it's full of insights, reflections, meditations, things like that, that I think are really like, just like healing balm for right now. So if that's something that you could use, you should go check that out as well.
You know, what I love about some of the themes in that book is that, so much of it is about slowing down and really,
yes,
and really taking that moment for gratitude, for self-care, for all the components. And in preparation, yes, of this interview, I was listening to some past interviews that you did. I listened to one that you did with Marie Forleo, who also been a past guest in this podcast. And I was just thinking about, that was 2017. I think you did that interview. And, you know, you were talking about the book and having been out there. And I just think, like, wow, if there was the beautiful silver lining is, I guess, through COVID, we've had a little bit of a slowdown. So we can actually, yes, now, for anybody that's saying that I wish the world would have just paused so I can actually do these things. Well, you got that now. You got a little bit of that now.
Right.
And it's a great opportunity to remind ourselves of some of those basics. And I think a lot of people are thinking, how do I continue some of the beautiful things that have happened? Again, a lot of job loss, a lot of other very tragic things, a lot of death, of course, but the beautiful things that have happened on an individual level for families, having dinner together, how can we continue some of that and that self-care? And I think the book is a great companion for bringing that in into our regular way of being and not just waiting for a pandemic to happen, you know, the next time.
Exactly. Thank you for that, Drew. Yeah, we all need Drew's book, by the way, which I'm waiting on. So book on lifestyle and a life well lived, which is going to be coming, I think, 2022. So I'm giving you a deadline, Drew.
All right, 2022. You heard it first. Latham, I appreciate you. I thank you for being a guiding light, a beacon of really wellness and living in this conversation. All the conversations are important, but there has to be a possibility that we're pulled toward in the future. And I really see you bringing that to the community. And I really think it's a conversation that not only needs, but people want to happen. So thank you for joining us on the Broken Brain Podcast. And thank you for being an incredible friend.
Aw, thank you. And I love you. This is awesome.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search there, find a provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.